This is the time when we feel the Spirit moving in our heart and moving among us. It's time when we make sacred. We do so by coming together, by sharing our love, by feeling the Spirit, and by hearing the messages of this faith and being challenged by them. As Mike lights our chalice, I invite you to join in the words of the covenant printed in your order of service. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. I have to admit that I am technically challenged, so I am appreciative of Hector for his help. When I was preparing for this sermon, I was working with the words of Opal Tometi, and I thought, how much better for this service would it be for you to hear about Black Lives Matter from her own words, than from me. So I invite you now to, instead of a reading, to see and hear her speak her own words.
So, how many of you know that the uprising we saw in August 2014 and throughout much of the fall was not in response solely to the murder of Mike Brown or Eric Garner or the non-indictments? Y'all know that, right? So how many of you know that it was actually a collective response to the decades of racial injustice? An assault that has weighed heavily on the Black community. Y'all knew that, right? And I just want to make sure, you know, so we're clear. You know, so that when my sisters, Patrice Colores, Alicia Garza, and I began Black Lives Matter as a political project back in 2013, in the wake of the murder of Trayvon Martin and the subsequent acquittal of George Zimmerman, it was because we knew the entire system was guilty, right? It was guilty of state violence. And we wanted our communities to give voice to that. While at the same time, it was out of a deep desire to share love with our people, to remind ourselves that Black lives matter. Our lives do, in fact, matter. A recent Salon article compiled some alarming research. One of the reports they found showed that white people, including police, see Black children as older and less innocent than white children. And another UCLA psychological study surveyed mostly white male officers to determine prejudice and unconscious dehumanization of black people. And in that study, they found a correlation between officers who unconsciously dehumanized black people and those who had used force against black children in their custody. Now, this same study also found that white female college students saw black and white children as equally innocent until age 9. But after age 9, black children were viewed as much older than their non-black counterparts. Then, of course, there have been other studies that show white people feel less empathy toward black people in pain than they do for their white counterparts experiencing pain. And several other reports that find that white people view lighter-skinned African Americans and Latinos as more, quote, intelligent, competent, trustworthy, and reliable than their darker-skinned peers. Now, these findings I've shared from these reports are implicit biases. They're ways of thinking that inform the way our entire society works. And what the Black Lives Matter co-founders, so myself, Patricia, and I, believed when we started this project is that it was time to do away with respectability politics. We will not be blamed for our brutality against us or murder. We won't be blamed for being poor or being a woman or being undocumented, transgendered, or queer. We won't be blamed for wearing a hoodie or for not being in the right place at the right time. We knew that we needed to move the conversation about personal responsibility and even interpersonal dynamics around race to a conversation about the role of the state in sanctioning these biases and creating and promoting violence against black bodies. And when we began the project, it was our vision that Black Lives Matter would transform the way we look at issues of racial injustice and police brutality. Now, the three of us, as community organizers, wanted to spark a flame, but we also desired to organize to fundamentally change our nation and our world. When we created Black Lives Matter Project in 2013, it was intended to expand the conversation to include all of black life in public discourse, because this brutality is something our communities have been facing ever since we were kidnapped from Africa, enslaved, and then forced to work in the U.S. Yeah. Hashtag Black Lives Matter is a pushback against the status quo. We are naming that we are not living in a post-racial society. Yeah. And we decidedly wanted the nation to confront anti-black racism, especially since there's been the move to more politically correct terms such as people of color, which, to be honest, is an overgeneralization that doesn't get to the heart of the ways in which black people are typically most acutely impacted by injustice, because our laws don't take account of structural racism. Now, it's paramount that our society recognize the role of anti-black structural racism in the U.S., and that our 21st century multiracial social movements uplift and centralize the issues of those community members who are impacted and are living at the margins. We know that if we do, we'll get closer to real justice for all of us. Moreover, it's been widely documented that the gains made by and with the Black community have always led to better standards of living for all of us. Right? And by all, I mean all, right? Right? So the challenge for us is to realize that anti-Black racism operates at a society-wide level. It colludes in a seamless web of policies, practices, and beliefs to oppress and disempower Black communities. Systemic racism reinvents itself to conform to what is publicly acceptable, leaving the quality of Black life diminished and more permanently fixed with each passing decade. And any outcry or attempt to expose this cycle of oppression is often ignored or dismissed by broader U.S. society because it seems rational or insignificant. Family, we must divest from this structural oppression. Must. And this divestment has no partisan affiliation. And I appreciate this because as people of faith, our affiliations are far deeper. Our affiliations are to a divine knowledge of our dignity, our own sacredness manifest on earth. And the intent that God would actually have us all free. As people made in the image of the Creator, we too are designed to be creators. We are designed to be the architects of our own human destiny. And anything, I mean anything, that stands against that is an affront to all of humanity. So I believe that communities of faith have the texts, have the teachers, the prophets, who've pointed to the fact that it is our duty to radically love one another and to commit to one another for the sake of our collective liberation. Because whether or not we like it, we are bound to one another.
Black lives matter. I think we struggle with those words. We feel uncomfortable saying them. We're not sure how or if we should connect with this movement. We want to say all lives matter. We want to mass things together, bring them under some universal principle or overarching concept. In doing so, it makes us more comfortable. It diverts our attention from the real issue. It allows us to avoid what is really central in this discussion that for a long time, in many ways, in many of our institutions, Black lives have really not mattered as much as white lives. There are many different attitudes and misunderstandings about the Black Lives Matter movement. So I wanted you to hear about it from the source, from one of its founders, Opal Tometi. You've heard her words this morning. There's so much in them, but I want to repeat just one short paragraph of her remarks as a way of entering into this sermon, and because I think they truly capture why this movement has risen up, and what it's all about. We're at a time of a new discussion of race, inequality in our nation. This racism is something bigger and more persuasive than either individual attitudes or legal rights. She put it this way. Anti-black racism operates at a society-wide level. It colludes in a seamless web of policies, practices, and beliefs to oppress and disempower black communities. Systemic racism reinvents itself to conform with what is publicly acceptable, leaving the quality of black life diminished and more permanently fixed with each passing decade, and any outcry or attempt to expose this cycle of oppression is often ignored or dismissed by the broader U.S. society because it seems rational or insignificant. As I read her words this week, preparing for this sermon, I watched them play out on my television. I didn't have to go back to incidents of police killings or mass incarcerations of black men to talk about this topic. This week's news illustrated systemic racism in yet another place, another institution. This week, the president and chancellor of the University of Missouri were forced to resign after a black student went on a hunger strike and the football team, largely black, refused to pay, potentially costing the university millions of dollars. Money talks. But students of color at that university had been asking the white administration to do more about racist incidents and attitudes on campus and the lack of a more diverse faculty and student body for a long time. The school's leadership administration was slow to act and did little. Oh, they spoke in those broad principles that we like, condemning racism, but they dismissed basically each individual incident as insignificant and failed to see the larger picture. Opal Tometi said in that video, "You know, it's not about one incident, right?" Do we know that? I'm not sure we do. It seems we like to look at each incident with an eye to find other reasons than racism for what happened. So we can say to the black community, "Oh, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time," or, "Oh, it looked like a real gun," or, "Oh, it's too bad he was wearing a hoodie," or, "Oh, I'm sorry there are no qualified black professors," or, "Oh, I'm only joking. Can't we make fun of each other? Don't take it so seriously." We want to find a reason to blame the black person for their oppression because we don't want the incidents to add up. We don't want to see what's behind the curtain, what's pulling the levers. Instead, we want to rationalize, prioritize, or deem insignificant each little incident that has happened, each racist remark, each failure of sensitivity, each intentional or unintentional action that demeans or excludes a black person. Also this week, a professor at Yale was highly criticized for her First Amendment response to a notice that requested students to avoid dressing in offensive Halloween costumes, particularly those that might be racially offensive. She responded that free speech was a sacred right and it applied to everyone, so persons should not be prohibited from expressing themselves and their beliefs, no matter how offensive. She suggested that doing so would invite dialogue, and those offended by a costume should go up to the person wearing it and tell them that they were offended. Really? If you're the only black person at the party, and someone comes in blackface, and everyone's joking about it, are you going to go up and say, "Your costume offends me"? I don't think so. What about the safety and the basic comfort of the few black students at Yale? Now, constitutionally speaking, the professor is not wrong about free speech. And a great university like Yale rightly treasures that principle, and we all should. But why did she feel she needed to raise it in this context? Why couldn't she feel why those remarks would be better left unsaid at this time? And why could she not focus on what was the real issue raised rather than her lofty, do I dare say, white privilege constitutional analysis of the request? In both situations, what those university people did was not really wrong, but they were oblivious to and dismissive of something very important that's coming to the forefront in our society right now. The comfort of being white causes us to fail to really grasp the whole picture of what's happening. Oh, we see pieces of it, but not the whole. We don't approve of it, but we don't feel the urgency of the situation as a black person does. As white folks, we have to wake up to the fact that we have a luxury of even doing this kind of analysis, this opportunity to raise lofty principles, to explain away and minimize incidents, to reframe discussions in ways that hide the cumulative effect and divert the attention from the real problem of structural racism. We fool ourselves, but we don't fool our black brothers and sisters. Black folks need to proudly and strongly proclaim Black Lives Matter because they have felt time and again that their lives did not. They need to claim their dignity and worth. They need to speak out to the institutional racism that permeates this country. And so do we. All of us white people need to proclaim Black Lives Matter as a way of saying we get it, as a reminder to ourselves to do what we can to push our society to divest from structural racism that taints so many of our institutions. Saying all lives matter won't do it. You have to look it in the face. You have to say the words. You have to name who is being left out of all lives matter in this country right now. Yes, we've passed laws that have helped us to move forward, but within our institutions, there is something deeply embedded that laws don't reach and don't really counteract. Of course, with these laws, certain racist behavior is no longer acceptable. The blatant racism has become more subtle, but it's not gone away. As Opal Tometi put it, systemic racism reinvents itself to conform with what's publicly acceptable, leaving the quality of black life diminished and more permanently fixed with each passing decade. Isn't that what's happened in our police departments, in our court system, some of our healthcare delivery system, even in our universities? I'm not saying that most police officers or college presidents are acting from an intentionally racist point of view. Instead, they're functioning in an institutional structure that is racially biased. We've all been raised with those institutions, and we value them. It's hard to say they are fundamentally flawed. I know my use of the saying, Black Lives Matter, will result in someone characterizing me as anti-police. Now, those of you who know me, my history that includes 8 years as an assistant district attorney working with police every day and sometimes depending upon them for my safety, know that's not the case. I'm not anti-police, but I'm anti-racism in police departments. 60 years ago, we thought passing laws would fix everything. We passed some great civil rights legislation. And of course, it helped a great deal, but still we know there is something deeper in our society that still results in black people not being treated with the same dignity as whites. This week I was in a discussion with some folks at church on this subject, and not surprisingly, someone said we need some black person to tell us how to fix it. It's not it that needs to be fixed. It's us that needs to be fixed. Us who are so invested in the structural oppression that we often can't even see it. Last Sunday, along with a couple of folks from here, I was at the Unitarian Universalist Urban Ministry for a wonderful dialogue between Shea Stewart Boulle and Debbie Irving, a black woman and a white woman who have dedicated their lives to this issue. In fact, I commend Debbie's book, Waking Up White, to you. It's great to study this further. And also Shea's blog, I think it's called Black Girl in Maine, is also very powerful. Many things came from that discussion, but one part of it was about fixing things. And I think it was Debbie who said, those of us who have lived with this subtle racism permeating our society are simply not going to see an end to it. She used a computer analogy to explain her point, and I thought, wow, with these techies in this congregation of mine here, I need to bring that back to them. So here's what she said. She said, this racism is part of our hard drive, and we don't get a new hard drive. But we do get to write better and better software to minimize the blow of that bug that permeates our hard drive. They also both said that the number one thing we can do is work on ourselves and particularly see to it that our children grow up free of racial biases as best we can in a society that preaches them. They also spoke of being allies, but Shea said she didn't like that term. She said, what we need to be is not allies, but co-conspirators. Allies, you see, are behind the scene and they support you, but co-conspirators are out there putting themselves at risk of criticism and even worse. A co-conspirator shares responsibility for actions. That's why we need to say Black Lives Matter, to be co-conspirators with Black people for change, not mere allies. Institutional changes come about when white people proclaim that Black Lives Matter, not just when Black people do. It's time to rebuild our institutions with new building blocks that are not tainted with racial bias. Every one of those blocks has to say on it, Black Lives Matter. And we have to get down to the very foundation of those institutions to make those changes. You know, many of us were so naive just a few years ago when we elected a black president, and we bought into this idea that we lived in a post-racial or at least almost post-racial time. What the Black Lives Matter movement is telling us is that we clearly do not. But we're still moving in that direction. And I think right now is a time for a new wave of progress. I think this spiritual that the choir sang, Great Day, really captures something about our time. Just as when it was sung in the days of slavery, it was not a celebration of a great day in the sense that things had been accomplished, that particular day was great. The time of slavery was not a great day, and a time when 3 out of 4 black men served time in jail is not a great day, and a time when every 28 hours a black person is killed by a police officer, security guard, or vigilante is not a great day, a time when white students at some of the finest universities in our country demean black students and there's little support for the black students from the administration is not a great day. But as that spiritual says, it's a great day in the sense that the righteous perhaps have awakened and, quote, they are marching. They're not there yet, but they're marching. The result of that is starting to have an impact. The walls of Zion, as it refers to, the place of true justice and equality and peace, are rising up. They're being built up. You know, Zion's a very complex concept in Scripture, but here I believe it means a place of changed people, changed structure, changed institution, changed society. It's a message not of celebration today, but as a recognition that we at least see the problem and stumble as we may, tripping over our white privilege and our analytical minds, trying to see things through our fears, yet are willing to help bring about change. It reflects a willingness to say, we will no longer deceive ourselves into thinking the work is done, not even nearly done. It reminds us, if we are the righteous, that we have to be those co-conspirators who are willing to say with others that black lives matter. Zion wasn't built in a day, and racism is not going away overnight. But the Black Lives Matter movement has given us a new place, I think, to start addressing the structural racism that still permeates our society and institutions. The more I engage with racism, the more deeply embedded I find it to be. But I take new hope from Opal and her co-founders of the Black Lives Matter for calling us to the next chapter in the civil rights movement. It'll be a long journey, but I do believe we are marching and that we shall overcome someday.